Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Extra Point Podcast. Today's Tuesday, January the 7th, and welcome to our first Extra Point Podcast of the year. Some of you may know that we are releasing some podcasts regarding prayer and fasting on this same channel, but this is the first one of the year related to our normal protocol, which is to talk about the text from which we preached the previous Sunday. And so today's the 7th, it's Tuesday. We're looking back at Sunday the 5th, and we preached from Matthew 25, 14 through 30. It was our first week in a four-week series on stewardship. We looked at the parable of the servants, two of them being faithful, one being unfaithful, or the words of the text were evil, lazy, and good for nothing. We're looking at that parable, and so we did take some questions in the service. Only a couple at each service. Many more came in, so I want to spend this podcast answering the remaining questions. And the first one we'll answer, by the way, is the one that I passed on in the 8:30 service. If you were there, you were able to, I mean, you saw live that it just was a question I didn't quite understand on the spot. And I even admitted to you there, in the service, like, I'm not sure I'm following the train of thought in this question. And so I said, hey, if you wrote this, see me afterwards. Let's see if we can get to the heart of the question. Well, I did talk to that person. Wonderful conversation. And I got a lot more understanding about what they were after. So I'm going to start with that question. Let me read to you the question that was in the service that was posted. We all read it and saw it, those of us in the 8:30 service. But it was this question here. How do you reconcile this passage with the risk-reward continuum that God has created each of us on individually? And so even reading that now, there's some things in there that I was just initially, I wasn't sure what they meant. First of all, the idea of reconciling the passage, I was wondering if they felt like the passage was then in conflict with this idea of a risk-reward continuum that God has created each of us on. And I was curious, is there something that I'm missing? I wasn't aware that if this was like an actual thing, and this is a known concept, and I wasn't really aware of it myself, even though I got the impression that what they're asking was a temperament that some people are more prone to risk and some are less prone to risk. In other words, some are more risk, they're at ease with risk, and some are aversive to risk. And so was this person meaning that? And, you know, how do you reconcile the passage, which talks about multiplying whatever you've been given, multiplying the kingdom of God for God's purposes, making sure that we have this mindset? How do you reconcile that with maybe those who are, you know, less prone to risk? And so as I called the person, we chatted, this is exactly what they were after. Like, there are those who's, they're not risk tolerant at all. And so yet the text seems to say that faithful servants are the ones who embrace a fruitful mindset. As we said Sunday, faithfulness is fruitfulness. And though we don't always see it in our lifetime or immediately, this is what proves that we've been faithful, is the fruitfulness that we're willing to go after, that we're willing to invest, diligently invest for the kingdom so that there are eternal treasures laid up in heaven. Much like Matthew 13, the only one to really have the seed was the one who produced fruit. Though the seed was sown on all kinds of ground, admittedly, yes to that. At the end of the day, over time, the ground that proved to have the seed and own the seed was the ground that produced fruit. And so there's some of this going on. Let me just see if I can answer the question, which again is this: how do you reconcile this passage with the, and I'm going to change the wording here, with the fact that we're all created differently when it comes to risk? That some of us, you know, we tolerate a lot of risk. Some don't tolerate much risk. There's different capacities when it comes to risk. So how do you reconcile this passage with that fact? And let me just simply say this. I think the best answer is not to give people who have low risk tolerance a pass. Neither should we give those who have high risk tolerance like a higher grade spiritually. I don't think we ought to do either of those extremes. much like in the passage, you know, there was the two talent servant and the five talent servant, and both got the same commendation. So my answer would be this. However God's created you and wired you in relation to risk, it is incumbent upon you to figure out how to embrace a multiplying, reproducing mindset, even with that or in light of that. In other words, I don't think just because we're made a certain way that we get to get a pass on really what God expects from his servants. And he expects all of us as stewards and managers to think about how we can multiply what he's given us. Some will do that in a different way than others because they have a low tolerance for risk. I'm okay with that, but they're still pursuing and, can we use the words, chasing after the advancement of or the multiplication of or the growth, the investment of things into God's kingdom and then seeing how he will produce from that and multiply from that. It may not look the same way as the person with a high risk tolerance, just as capacities and capacity levels differ, so those things look differently. It kind of all goes to the same end result that no one gets a pass from this responsibility, that we are accountable to God for using everything he's entrusted to us in a way that at the end of the day, it is multiplied for God's kingdom. And we're not sure how much multiplication that means. That varies. God's the judge of all that. And we don't produce that multiplication. That's God's responsibility, and he does that. It's ours to invest what he's given us, whether it be our time, our knowledge, our possessions, our money, our energies, is to invest that into God's kingdom in a way that it can be multiplied. And so that's the mindset we have to be willing to have. So whether you're a low-risk person or whether you're a high-risk person, to use the words in the question, wherever you fall on the risk continuum, be sure that you're willing to embrace this reality that God expects and desires and wants you and will empower you to bring that very personality and temperament he gave you to the table of multiplication so that it's used, so that everything he's entrusted to you, everything you're stewarding and managing for his glory is able to be multiplied and put to further use and gains further ground, sees a return in some way when all is said and done. And if that's your posture, then enjoy wherever you are on the continuum, because that's what's pleasing to God, is putting everything, investing all that he's entrusted to us so that he can use it in greater ways as he sees fit. All right, next question that came in. This person asked for a little more explanation about the phrase in Matthew 25:26. Now, 25:26 is when the master repeats what the servant, the third servant, said about him. In fact, that's in verse 24. The third servant, in a very accusatory way, he gives his impression of the master. He says he's harsh. He reaps where he hasn't sown. He gathers where he hasn't scattered. So the question is this. Can you give some more insight into this phrase where the master says, you know, he reaps where he's not sown. He gathers where he's not scattered. The question is, when this is repeated by the master, is he confirming the accusations? Is he just repeating the accusations, or is something else entirely happening here? Really good question. Here's my best take on this. I base it on the use of the word if. It's in verse 26. It too is a repeat of what the man said in verse 24. The man said, the third servant said, I know that you reap where you haven't sown, you gather where you haven't scattered. I know you're a harsh man. And so he's now repeating this accusation, so to speak, but he's putting the word if in front of it, which says to me, this isn't true about the master. It's the third servant's perception of the master. And though the master says to him, if you knew that was true, then why didn't you do, you know, X? And of course, what he says is, why didn't you put the money in the lowest level type of investment, the safest way to gain a return, which would be the banks. That's what he says in the passage. Instead, the man buried it. So I think he's saying, no, you really didn't believe that I was harsh. You didn't. You actually are accusing me of things that you actually don't believe yourself. Because if you really did believe that, you would have acted differently. The fact that you buried it and did nothing with it, acted like it wasn't yours, you tried to distance yourself from it, the master is saying this, it shows me that you really didn't believe that after all. So I think it's simply a way to repeat the accusations, which it's really just a moment of blame shifting. And so he's calling that out, saying, if you really believed it, which you actually don't, because it's actually not true, then you would have acted differently. So no, I don't think it's a repeat accusation that's true. He's not confirming accusations. He's simply saying, he's kind of exposing or calling out the third servant. If you really believe what you said, you would have acted differently, but you didn't act differently. So even you don't believe what you're saying. This is just a moment in which you're blame shifting and trying to save face. And he calls him out. So I hope that helps a little more with some explanation as to those phrases. I will add this as well. The phrases, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. It's really just a phrase that describes working through someone else as opposed to doing the actual manual labor yourself. In other words, he's saying that perhaps he does reap where he wasn't the one who sowed the seed. That doesn't mean that that's wrong reaping. Maybe he purchased the field. Maybe he's paying the laborers. It's still his field. It's still his harvest. So he's gaining ground through another indirect method, we'll call it, but it's not a sinful or wrong method. And the third servant here makes it out to be like it's wrong, but I don't know that the phraseology here or even the concept is wrong in and of itself. He's just saying that perhaps, he's an investor, he's an entrepreneur, and he works through people to see a return even when he wasn't the one who actually did the labor. That could be what he's referring to here. And so regardless of how you read those phrases, I think the master simply saying what you said, you don't even believe yourself because you didn't act differently. So that's hopefully some help on that question as well. Let's move to a third question, which I really, really loved. This person asks something that I mentioned in the first service, didn't mention this in the second service, but I thought it was a very a good, keen bit of insight. The question is this, how do we know the word immediately in verse 15 describes the first servant's investment rather than the master's journey? It's a great question. I did mention in the first service that the word immediately is the last word of verse 15, but it's actually the first word of the next sentence, which is about the first servant's investment. It's the word immediately, and I believe it describes how quickly the first servant got to work. But in some translations, and mainly the one I'm thinking of is the King James, it seems to describe the master's journey, in which it says he left at once or he left immediately. So I just simply said, I think the word immediately goes with the servant's action, not the master's journey. And he writes, how do we know that? Now, he does make a good point here that in the original language, Koine Greek, of course, there is no actual punctuation. So you have to make a really solid attempt at understanding context and the sense of the story, the sense of the narrative, or, the passage in view. And then you have to supply some of those things. I think that the newer translations have this right when they put the word immediately with the servant's investment, because the sense of the story is get to work. The master's gone. The sense of the story isn't that the master left quickly. In fact, it's just the opposite. The real ambiance of the text is, the nuance is, the master left, gave good instructions because they knew he'd be gone a long time. A quick departure isn't really part of the story at all. If it was so quick, he might not have given these kind of instructions. He apparently seems to have taken time to, with the servants. A lot of detail was laid out. And the expectation was, I think, inherently and insinuated that there'd be some return because they'll have a good bit of time while he's gone. And so I think the word immediately is much better suited to the servant's action because it fits the overall context of the story. But to the point of the question, how do we know that it belongs there? We probably don't. It is a solid attempt, and it has people who disagree on that. Earlier, older translations seem to put it with the master's journey. Newer ones seem to put it with the servant's actions. I tend to land with the latter. But to answer your question, how do we know that? We don't. But a better, can I use the word guess here? A better hypothesis is to see that it fits contextually with the servant's actions, not the master's journey. Let's move on to our next question. This person asks, how do you walk the line of works-based salvation and grace-based salvation if someone can be this close but still not actually saved? Now, on this question, I think it would be helpful if you've not heard the message yet to listen to the message, because you'll understand why this person's asking the question. We made a pretty strong point that at the end of the story, it's clear that the third servant, the one who was called evil, lazy, and good for nothing, didn't really belong in the circle of servants, though it seemed like they did. And I maintain that though they had a talent, they did everything. This servant did everything he or she could to distance themselves from it, but yet tried to access it and, you know, kind of like enjoy the benefits of it, and yet really didn't want to attach themselves to it. I even made this statement that true stewards, true managers, faithful servants, they know they don't own what they're managing, but they live like they do. And so this person now is asking, like, well, if at the end of, the end of the situation, at the coming of Christ, at this final judgment, if someone can actually be this close, like actually appear to be in and yet actually not be in, how does this not look like perhaps works-based salvation? Like if you do certain things, that means you're in. I think the answer is this. Salvation is never by works. It's a gift from God, but salvation is always proven by work. And so this is a fine line in one sense, because we know that Matthew 7, and I mentioned this in the 10:30 service, there's this moment at the end, of course, in the coming judgment, when Christ will say, though you've done all these things, they're repeating, you know, we did this in your name, we cast out demons. He says, I never knew you. So we have to admit that the Bible does give the narrative that some will look like they're saved and they're actually not. So what this says to us is this, that works don't produce salvation, but salvation does produce work. And yet not every work is indicative of salvation. And only God really knows the heart. And so we have to just land on what the Bible teaches and be content with that, that there is no such thing as works-based salvation. It's a false doctrine. We're not saved by our works, and yet grace-based salvation, which is what we believe and the Bible teaches, does result in works. Philippians says this when Paul said to work out your own salvation. And so it's just a constant, she calls it walking the line. It's not really a balancing act, because we're not balancing works-based salvation with anything. We don't even believe in that. That's not even true. What we're balancing is the fact that it's grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. But when that exists and is true and authentic and real, it does not stay alone forever. It is always then joined with works that are produced by this grace and faith in Christ alone. It produces a life given to service, energy and output for the kingdom. But that energy and output and those works don't do anything to produce the salvation. The salvation produces all of the works. And so we hold to and maintain that salvation's by faith, it's grace-based alone, and then the works are produced as a result of that. So the last part of the question, can someone be this close but still not actually saved? I think that is just true. It's hard to grasp. It's difficult to keep both of these in the same set of hands. But the Bible is replete with admonitions to make sure you're examining yourself, to make sure that your obedience is indicative that you've truly been born again. And so, in that case, like John, when he writes that in 1 John, he's not saying, so do more so that you can get saved. He's saying, if you realize that there's a lack of obedience, don't just keep doing something. Instead, trust Christ. Deal with the root first, and then you will see the right kind of fruit. So, good bit of words there. I'm not sure it's a solid, succinctly solid answer. But I just want to make sure that this is crystal clear. I don't know if we're walking a line in regards to works-based and grace-based. There is no line to walk. It's always grace-based. And I'm sure this person believes that. I think they're just wrestling with and grappling with the fact that it's hard to admit sometimes that someone could look like they're actually saved and maybe they're actually not. And you know what? We don't know who those people are. It's up to us to examine ourselves. Each person should have that conversation with themselves in the mirror. But this reality exists that wheat and tares often grow together. And because we don't really know what's at the root of a lot of these things, this is why Jesus told the disciples, don't go and try to pick out the tares from the wheat before I come. He said, let me do that when I come. And so I would just release this person and release all of us from the burden of trying to figure out the heart. Let's just continue to preach the gospel, how it's trusted and believed in for salvation, and then how the true gospel, when believed in, produces works from salvation. Let's keep preaching that, and then we'll leave the rest of the results to God, and He'll settle all the final matters when He comes. Much like the text says in the parable, He will settle the accounts when He comes back. And I'm so thankful that He's the account settler, not me. Our last question is this one. It says, if the master knew the third man was not like the first two, why did he choose him? So that's a good question. I would ask this question in return. Did the master choose him? So even the question itself might be assuming something. Now, it may be a correct assumption. I don't know. But all we know is that the parable is describing three people who at the end of the day, it was revealed that only two actually were the kind of servants that belonged to the master. So I don't know if the master chose the third one. I don't know if that's even really the issue of the parable. I would just ask this person, why are you assuming the master chose him? Here's maybe an illustration that I can give you that, again, will just produce probably some tension in your heart. It may produce some grappling in your mind, but it would be in the same vein. There were 12 disciples. Yes, Jesus chose those 12. One of them was Judas, who really was never a genuine disciple. And so when you ask, did Jesus choose Judas? Well, yes, in a physical sense, but no, in a spiritual sense. Judas rejected, and yet he was very close. He was looked like he was in, but he really wasn't all those years. And so from a theological point of view regarding being chosen, no, spiritually, Judas was not chosen. And yet, did Jesus choose him? Well, of course he did in that physical, earthly moment to walk with him. He is described as the son of perdition at some point. And so there was this purpose that, he fulfilled. A lot of those things are hard to wrestle with. So perhaps some of that same mentality needs to be placed upon this, that there is a sense in which this third servant was chosen, I guess you could say. He looked like he was in. He played the part. He pretended to really be in. But yet, in one sense, he wasn't, because at the end of the day, it was revealed he never really owned, quote unquote, he never really owned his responsibility and was trying to distance himself from that accountability. And so he then was turned over. He was thrust out. He was given, you know, what they say, the gnashing of teeth and those phrases there to describe eternal punishment. So I would just say to this question, perhaps the master didn't choose him. That might be something you ought to wrestle with as well as you think about this question. But I didn't want to avoid it, wanted to ask it. Perhaps this question's best answered with another question. Did the master even choose him? So wrestle through that. But these are all interesting questions that have come in from Matthew 25. I would encourage you, if you'd like to hear the message, go to our social media pages or our Sermon Feed podcast channel. Check it out there. I'm glad this kind of stuff breeds so many questions. I'm glad we can talk about them. And I hope this has helped to bring some further insight into this text in Matthew 25, especially as it relates to stewarding and being a manager of all that God has entrusted, and that we would really adopt a posture of giving everything to our Lord in a way that it's invested diligently so that He can multiply for His purposes.
Thanks for listening to the Extra Point Podcast. To find more content and resources to grow deeper in your relationship with Jesus, go online to firstfamily.church/resources.